Well, good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program. The Defence of Government Schools are here every Saturday to defend and promote public education. And we're also against something. We're against the public funding of private schools, or the denominational system, if you like, the religious system that is causing so much trouble in our so-called cohesive society. And for that reason, we are supporters of separation of religion from the state. And we're going to be talking about that today because, glory be, the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald is almost agreeing with us because, and we think this is rather funny, they've caught the Catholic Church out. They're using taxpayers' money from the Catholic Education Office up there in New South Wales to fund the so-called reformers or the extreme right wing of the Liberal Party. They might as well be joining Gina Reinhardt, of course, with One Nation. But let's hear about it, shall we, in Press Release 1075.
Thanks, Jean. This is Dogs Press Release number 1075. Church school administrators and their political use of taxpayer funds. On the 30th of July 2026, an editorial entitled "Time for Catholics to be Transparent About Their Use of Other People's Money" appeared in the Sydney Morning Herald. The editor referred to the recent Independent Commission Against Corruption's ICAC's inquiry into Liberal factionalism and lobbying in New South Wales politics, which has traced a money trail used to undermine democratic processes. The head of Catholic Schools New South Wales and right-wing power broker Dallas McInerney has been accused of funneling $165,000 of his organisation's fund in undeclared political donations to factional colleagues. There have been a number of other articles by investigative journalists following young and not-so-young Catholic conservatives planning on imposing their peculiar views upon the rest of the population. These are: 1. Catholic schools' rort was a running joke. You won't hear parents or taxpayers laughing. And 2. From God to Godfather, the secretive young men behind the reformers. What is perhaps the most telling is the following excerpt from the editorial. Unlike government schools, which must remain politically neutral, Catholic priests and principals are free to advocate for particular parties and have done so when they have detected threats to their funding or their freedom to decide how it is spent. The lack of accountability has long been a sore point for politicians, but they fear political consequences if they call it out or attempt to change the rules to require private schools to explain how this multi-billion dollar handout is spent. Australia has always had an inclusive approach when it came to the separation of church and state that delivered religious freedom, religious fairness, and state neutrality. But we now have a real example of government funding being used for political purposes. Dogs note that entanglement of church and state through the provision of public funding for private religious schools will inevitably lead to situations like this. Accountability has long been a joke, and in fact will always be a joke. What is more deleterious for the body politic is the subtle and not so subtle division of children and their parents into religious tribes and the breakdown of social cohesion. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you so much, Dale. Well, we've quoted the editor from the Sydney Morning Herald, but let's hear from the horse's mouth, shall we? The actual editorial. Time for Catholics to be transparent about their use of other people's money. And here is Andy.
Thanks, Jean. Time for Catholics to be transparent about their use of other people's money. Whatever their beliefs, religious or otherwise, New South Wales taxpayers can rightly be outraged by allegations that some Catholics within the Liberal Party used funds intended to educate children within their own school system to further their personal internecine political ends. The Independent Commission Against Corruption's inquiry into Liberal Party factionalism and lobbying in New South Wales politics has traced a money trail used to undermine democratic processes. The head of Catholic Schools New South Wales and a right-wing power broker, Dallas McKinney, stands accused of funnelling $165,000 of his organisation's funds in undeclared political donations to factional colleagues seeking to recruit conservatives as members in the belief that Christian values were disappearing from society. Moreover, it has heard that at least two staff members working for Catholic Schools New South Wales spent some of their time on political work. One is accused of devoting more time to political work than to the job for which he was ostensibly employed. Catholic schools in New South Wales receive nearly $4 billion a year from the Commonwealth and New South Wales governments, accounting for almost 80% of the sector's income. Catholic Schools New South Wales, the governing body for 600 schools, distributes annual funding through its diocesan school system. It also raises some $550 million from school fees. The High Court in 1981 held that federal support of non-government schools operated by religious organisations did not breach the Constitution when funding was for ordinary educational purposes. The Catholic Church in Australia has gladly accepted the money without ever opening their books to properly provide taxpayers a clear idea of what happens to the funds. Few countries are as willing to provide such generous funding to religious schools, and the Vatican regards Australia's system as the gold standard. Australia's Catholic leaders, who have significant political influence, have guarded it carefully. Unlike government schools, which must remain politically neutral, Catholic priests and principals are free to advocate for particular parties and have done so when they have detected threats to their funding or their freedom to decide how it's spent. The lack of accountability has long been a sore point for politicians, but they fear political consequences if they call it out or attempt to change the rules to require private schools to explain how this multi-billion dollar handout is spent. Australia has always had an inclusive approach when it comes to the separation of church and state that delivered religious freedom, religious fairness, and state neutrality. But now we have a real example of government funding being used for political purposes. In her opening statement, counsel assisting the commission, Peggy Dwyer SC, said it was not suggested that Catholic Schools New South Wales as a body was responsible for McKinney's alleged actions or that its board members were aware of them. But the buck must stop somewhere. The ICAC hearings are exposing a worrying abuse of the system and an ethical failure by our political and religious leaders. This lapse is made all the more egregious at a time when so many public schools are struggling with under-resourcing. ICAC will deal with the Liberals. Meanwhile, the Catholic school system continues to be gifted an enormous lump sum with little accountability. ICAC shows the time has come for Catholics to be transparent about what they do with other people's money. Back to you, Jean.
Well, the Dogs and other people aren't terribly impressed with what Mr. McInerney and company have been doing. And Matt Bevan from the Sydney Morning Herald, an investigative journalist, has written an interesting article too. Catholic schools rot was a running joke, but you won't hear parents or taxpayers laughing. Over to Dale.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article by Bevan Shields. Catholic schools rot was a running joke. You won't hear parents or taxpayers laughing. ICAC's Operation Rosny is investigating property developer Jean Nassif's links to political power brokers, councils and Catholic schools. Taxpayers and parents of the 270,000 students in Catholic schools across New South Wales all have good cause to be disgusted by the evidence of financial abuse and breathtaking entitlement aired during a major corruption inquiry on Tuesday, the 28th of July this year. They also have a right to demand answers. The church has been in the crouch position ever since the Independent Commission Against Corruption revealed this month that Catholic Schools New South Wales chief executive Dallas McInerney was being investigated as part of a broader probe into the New South Wales Liberal Party's relationship with fugitive developer Jean Nassif. McInerney, a Liberal power broker and favourite ideological son of Conservative Archbishop Anthony Fisher, has ruled the governing body for over 600 diocesan Catholic schools for nearly a decade, often achieving significant results for the sector. But we now know, from evidence given at the inquiry, he was also allegedly using this position and the charity's hefty budget to hire Liberal operatives who would then use huge chunks of their time in the office working on a scheme to stack branches across Sydney with more Conservative members. One such apparatchik, Dylan Whitelaw, was hired straight out of school, no application or interview required. I asked him for the help, and he probably saw a young kid that he could bring under his wing, Whitelaw claimed of his May 2019 hiring by McInerney. It probably didn't hurt that McInerney was the president of the Mittagong wing of the Liberal Party when a teenage Whitelaw became the branch's secretary. Whitelaw eventually spent part of his time while in the Catholic Schools New South Wales office assigned to Dulles Projects, a code he and others used for work that involved supporting the ambitions of a group of right-wing Liberal members known as the Reformers. Another member of the Reformers, Robert Asaf, was also employed by Catholic Schools New South Wales. Whitelaw said he had a good view of Asaf's computer screen from his desk and estimated perhaps up to 60% of his time in the office was spent on building up the Reformers. I remember there being a bit of a joke at the time about how Rob did very little Catholic schools work and he did Liberal Party work, Whitelaw told the hearing. It became a bit of a running joke. Running joke? It might be a joke to entitled jumped-up infants like Whitelaw, but it is no joke for taxpayers who prop up Catholic Schools New South Wales or parents who pay fees to send their children to its schools. New South Wales Catholic schools receive nearly $4 billion a year from the Commonwealth and New South Wales governments, accounting for almost 80% of the sector's income. Catholic Schools New South Wales distributes that funding each year for the diocesan school system. It also raises more than $550 million in school fees. The evidence at the ICAC suggests that an important organisation has at times operated as a frat house for Liberal dudes to pursue their political ambitions. If the money used to hire Whitelaw and other cronies came from taxpayer contributions, it may constitute a breach of the New South Wales Education Act. If the money came from fees, parents have been helping to prop up a Liberal Party's branch stack in potential breach of the New South Wales Electoral Act. Neither option is good. In addition to Catholic Schools New South Wales's questionable employment history, McInerney is also accused of funneling $165,000 of its funds to Reformers figures over a number of years. Whitelaw said at Tuesday's hearing that a manager at Catholic School New South Wales, James Tudehope, knew Asaf was not always doing legitimate work for the organisation. Tudehope is in the sights of ICAC, but is in New Zealand and has declined to assist their inquiry. He is the son of Liberal MP Damien Tudehope, who will be called before the Operation Rosny in coming weeks. Whitelaw told Tuesday's hearing he now recognises the hirings represented a financial contribution to the Reformers. At the time, I wouldn't have thought that, Whitelaw, 25, insisted. On reflection and with a bit of maturity in the workplace that I've had over the last few years, I would suggest yes. His evidence contradicted earlier statements he gave to a New South Wales parliamentary inquiry in which he denied any knowledge of money being sought for branch stacking activities. Whitelaw is now employed by the State Emergency Service as a flood rescue and operations coordinator. His participation in a scheme which abused taxpayer funding raises serious questions about his future at the SES. McInerney is yet to have his turn in the witness box and may well deny allegations and dispute Whitelaw's evidence. But as it now stands, Tuesday's testimony is devastating to McInerney personally and for the church more broadly. The great risk for the Catholic Church is that the brazen behaviour which appears to be on display at the ICAC triggers a broader examination of its books. There have long been questions over whether every cent of taxpayer funds is used for legitimate educational purposes. While an extreme scenario, the worst case for church leaders would be a full-blown audit, which results in its education arm losing charitable status and tax exemptions. This is not about Catholic bashing. It's about transparency and accountability. One question ICAC might not ask, but which taxpayers and parents should over the coming weeks is this: will any politician in power stand up and ask the church for a please explain? God knows it's warranted. The state's corruption watchdog is proving its value with its latest blockbuster inquiry into Liberal personalities' links with a fugitive businessman. The federal opposition leader has not denied making donations to a religious faction of the New South Wales Liberals, which a former staffer was questioned about at ICAC. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Dale. And in this so-called Catholic rort, there's some very interesting young people. I don't know whether they're Office Day or what they are. They've got some interesting names, but there's a property developer somewhere in the background funding them. But let's hear about them, shall we? From God to Godfather, the secretive young men behind this group in the Liberal right-wing party called the Reformers.
Thanks, Jean. From God to Godfather, the secretive young men behind the Reformers. They began with the aim of taking back politics for right-wing Christian causes. Three of them ended up dealing with Jean Nassif, the ICAC has heard. Dylan Whitelaw, Robert Asaph, Christian Ellis and Jean-Claude Perrottet were all members of the New South Wales Reformers. ICAC's Operation Rosny is investigating property developer Jean Nassif's links to the political power brokers, councils and Catholic schools. The secretive group of young Christian men at the centre of this week's explosive Independent Commission Against Corruption inquiry were worried. "We're losing the culture war and it's our fault," says a training manual developed by the group that came to call themselves the New South Wales Reformers. The document lists a series of supposed culture war defeats, including the legalisation of same-sex marriage and the introduction of safe access zones around abortion clinics as evidence of the malaise afflicting the nation. That may not be the question for the ICAC, but it's one that many of us are asking. Reformers founder Robert Asaph says he was young and immature and did not understand political donation laws. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you so much, Andy. We're making a bit light of this, but actually it's very serious. And if you didn't laugh, then you'd cry at the state that our country's in with the corruption between the men of religion and the state. But let's have a break from all that, shall we?
3CR programs provide information and analysis you won't hear in the mainstream.
Today we'll be looking at the legacy of the US war on Vietnam on Laos.
And as far as corporate capitalism is concerned, it is the worst political and economic system that you can have.
Our laws about jailing refugees and asylum seekers are so well crafted.
Sex is not irrelevant and we like who we are, but we don't have to be imprisoned by our gender.
Become a subscriber today. Call us on 9419 8377 or visit 3cr.org.au. 3CR, the voice of dissent.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a container deposit scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.com www.rfugees.org.au for more information.
Well, you're listening to the Dogs Program, we hope, and we've got a very interesting article by Chris Bonner, who's a great public school man, but who, like a lot of people these days, is just not prepared to take on the religious interests. They somehow think that Gonski and giving enough money to everyone is going to solve the problem, and they romance about the integrated systems of New Zealand and Canada. But here he's writing again, and it's a very interesting article which we think you should hear about how it's crunch time for education in Australia, and he's right on that. Sorrel's going to tell us about his latest magnum opus.
Thanks, Jean. This article is entitled Crunch Time for School Education and was written by Chris Bonner. In the 1970s, Australia established our present system of funding for both public and private schools. Public schools remained fully funded, open and free to everyone. Private schools, partially funded by government, were open to some at a price. It was the perfect script to create today's mess. As Dean Ashenden has commented, we ended up with schools permitted to select on grounds of capacity to pay and or religious affiliation and or academic performance, and schools prohibited from doing any of those things. Parents who are required to pay when often they can't afford it, and parents who aren't and can, and parents who are offered a full menu, and others who must take whatever is put on their plate. Australia was unique in the democratic world, said another education specialist back in the 1980s. A kind of wonder at which people in other countries gape. It remains unique, people still gape, and it still doesn't work. The difference today is that half a century of accumulating problems, rusted on inequity and inequality, achievement gaps and more, are impossible to hide. What went wrong? Partisan politics and an ad hoc federalism are frequently blamed, and almost every reform fix thrown at the system has made little difference. Several countries resolved similar problems in the 1970s, but in very different ways. Canada's British Columbia funded their private schools at half the cost of running local public schools. They could charge fees for the other half, but would lose their funding if the fees raised more than that. It's not perfect, but BC's school system is in far better shape than ours. Subject to strict conditions, New Zealand fully funded most of its private schools. It's not perfect either, but they are well ahead of us in the equality and equity stakes. Australia's schools have long suffered the vagaries of politics, rampant vested interests and changing governments. Politics rule. Labour governments try to sustain needs-based funding. The coalition favours private schools. Both assume that any change, including to funding, could simply be grafted onto the existing public-private system with its contrasting and unequal obligations and resourcing. Hence, Australia's schools have become the socially divided system anticipated by its critics and avoided by other countries. Schools are now divided in almost every community. School choice, for those with the resources to choose, has become a scramble for perceived advantage, creating an apartheid-like social separation between low and higher status schools. As Ross Gittins once asked, what did the rich school student say to the poor school student? Answer, nothing. They never met. In the public mind, at least, the school's divide is between winning and losing schools. Hence the schools that have ended up towards the top of the socioeconomic pile, the growing private school sector, as well as selective or well-positioned public schools, are wedded to what we have. They are the schools that advantaged families admire and politicians don't want to touch. How do you change such a system? The answer may be that change becomes possible only when the system is so clearly failing that something has to give. We are now at that point. In recent years, inequity and unfairness across the system have drawn increasing attention, alongside concern about a parallel decline in overall student outcomes. While school funding issues are still with us, the last few years have seen a greater focus on the underpinning problems. Researchers have drilled down into the impact of the school divide on the most disadvantaged. Its cost is now measured in years of lost learning, but there are multiple other impacts. Dean Ashenden has successfully joined the dots between where we are and the narrowing of achievement measures, and indeed, of the whole purpose of schooling. Researcher Barbara Preston has shown how the very unlevel school playing field, still firmly in place, has affected schools. A new grassroots organisation, Schools for All Australia, is gathering together a diverse team to push the drive for solutions. Alongside growing doubts about incremental reform has come increasing interest in the idea of a common framework for all Australian schools. The charity Australian Learning Lecture, or ALL, supported a team of educators to see how this works overseas. Their report, Lessons from Canada, An Equal School System is Possible, describes structural solutions that have worked especially well in Ontario. In brief, a common framework for schools would require that public obligations, equity, openness, and so on, should apply equally to all publicly funded schools that sign up to the framework, including those considered private. To be part of the framework, schools would be free to the user and open to children of all abilities. They would be prohibited from excluding children on any basis other than their specific religious or educational ethos. In effect, all schools within the framework would be fully publicly funded to meet recurrent and capital costs on the same needs basis. Non-government schools that don't accept that requirement would receive no public funds. Knee-jerk reactions to this proposal have come from both public and private schools and their supporters. On the public side, the Australian Education Union seems to be showing a studied lack of interest. Its focus is overwhelmingly on industrial matters, teacher salaries and conditions, and efforts to achieve full Gonski funding. But not long ago, it commissioned research showing how Australian governments already give recurrent higher levels of funding to large numbers of private schools than to public schools with similar demographics. A finding that somewhat dates the main objection to the common framework, that it would boost funding to private schools. It is already happening, yet without anything near full public obligations. Also on the public side, Trevor Cobold from Save Our Schools, a pro-government school lobby group, has also fired a shot across the bows of a common framework. But both his objections and a response I co-wrote with Tom Greenwell illustrate how a reasonably constructive debate can be conducted, one that tackles the doubts and clarifications essential for any agreement. Inevitably, there are misunderstandings. A common framework wouldn't see private, especially church schools, becoming part of the secular public system. It would see them operating in parallel with public schools, but on a level playing field, open to all comers. Not one that unfairly creates winners and losers among kids, schools, and communities. Fixing the playing field requires that public funding of all schools must be accompanied by a comparable set of public obligations. Cobold won't be alone in declaring that a common framework is not politically possible. In his words, many private systems are highly unlikely to surrender the financial and structural privileges they currently enjoy. Indeed, if the experience overseas is any guide, many won't. In countries such as New Zealand, Britain, much of Europe, and Canada, the fully private sectors receive no public funding at all, and variously enroll between 5 and 8% of students. In the Australian context, the withdrawal of those schools from the framework would release up to $1 billion in funds each year, which would then go to participating schools. In fairness, Cobalt has searched for alternative solutions, the most recent including a Gonski Plus model that, he writes, would limit taxpayer funding of private schools to filling any gap between private income and the community resource standard. But that plan would require politicians to summon the courage, capacity, and political will to substantially cut private school funding, in the process shifting an additional burden onto parents. By contrast, a politician who gets a common framework could easily say to parents, "I'm going to lower your cost of living by completely removing one of the biggest pressures you are facing right now, school fees." For the first time ever, the choruses about school choice would change tune. Choice would no longer be a privilege of the wealthy. The strugglers could choose a private school. Enrollments would be more evenly spread, with spin-offs for all schools and overall levels of student achievement. No longer would public schools have to accept the lion's share of responsibility for the most disadvantaged and highest cost students. The ultimate bonus is that the never-ending conflict over religion, elitism, and choice could finally be consigned to history. How might the private school sectors eventually respond? Their difficulty is that the various arguments they have mounted haven't changed much over decades. Yes, there are more low-fee Catholic and independent schools these days, but even the lowest-fee school in a middle or struggling community discriminates in enrollments in a way that mocks school choice. It's not a good look, and proposals for a common framework leave it exposed. The challenge to the private sector is how to examine its assumptions and reshape its advocacy. Without this, its dated arguments will be seen as bending the truth in an inadequate justification of the status quo. Various claims commonly made about private schooling no longer stand up against qualifications or rebuttals. For example, private schools do not drain money from public schools. At the moment, they do. Governments can't fund in whole or in part two unequal systems. Private schools have less spend per student than public schools. They do indeed, but only public schools must be available to every student from every family in every circumstance and location. That costs. Private schools are not elitist. But in almost every case and place, their enrollment comes from higher SES families. Private schools achieve better results than public schools. No, they don't. Schools with similar demographics, regardless of sector, have similar results. Private school students have better post-school outcomes. Which outcomes? It's a bold claim, variously challenged over the last decade. Parents choose private schools for many reasons, not just academic performance. In this context, so what? In fairness, such claims usually derive from private school peak groups and cheer squads rather than the schools themselves. Inevitably, they rely on misleading averages of inputs and outputs, for example, funding and test scores, of often dissimilar groups of schools. The challenge to all sectors in any debate is to put such nonsense aside and engage with what the real world of schools has become. By any measure, the status quo is not an option. It is inherently corrosive to the mainly public schools drawing their students from lower socioeconomic families, while schools towards the top of the heap will remain better resourced because they can charge fees, as well as receiving generous public subsidies. They would continue to exclude, whether intentionally or otherwise, children who are more expensive to educate. This reality exposes many public schools to an inexorable dynamic of segregation and residualization. The trend has reached alarming proportions in the last 8 years. The federal government especially seems open to creative solutions to rusted-on problems. As Sean Kelly recently wrote, when the government began talking about a broken status quo, it focused on housing and tax, which was recently broadened by the Prime Minister to encompass the entire economy, and then followed by Treasurer Jim Chalmers, who said, "The status quo is not working for people, in both the economy and society. Schools must be front and centre of better policy and planning. They are not only part of the economy and society. In no small measure, they create both." Back over to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Sorrel. And, you know, it's very interesting what Chris Bonner has to say. And his heart's in the right place. The sad thing is that, like so many, he's frightened of being called sectarian and taking religious people front on. Well, at least the editor of the Sydney Morning Herald was prepared to do that. So we give, and Matt Bevan, so we give them a big thank you from the dogs. But we would have liked to have talked to you about the teachers this week, but they are in negotiations. We thought that there was going to be another strike, but it hasn't happened. And there's been a changing of the guard in the Labor Party in Victoria, and there's a new education minister. So we'll keep you informed as best we can. But let's now go overseas with Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. Today I'm going to do a longer article. It's from ProPublica by Jennifer Smith-Richards, Megan O'Matt, Molly Simon and Jennifer Berry-Hawes. And I just want to say that it illustrates what happens when you let the entrepreneurs loose on the school system, taking public money and funding a myriad of really badly regulated private schools. Barns, go-karts and strip malls, the wild west of private schools that collect taxpayer dollars. A decade ago, the state of Florida stripped a teacher of her license for sexual abuse of a 16-year-old boy. Last year, she opened a private school there with ease. Her name and photo were on the school's website, and details of her case were easy to find with an online search. The state also knew that a transplanted Midwesterner had been fired from her Cincinnati charter school following felony charges related to misuse of public funds, and had been banned from teaching or running schools in Ohio. Yet Florida did not stop her from starting a private school or collecting public money. As private schools proliferate in Florida and across the country, fueled by taxpayer dollars, states are choosing not to closely regulate who is operating them or to oversee student safety and achievement, a ProPublica investigation found. The backgrounds of school founders and employees often simply don't matter. In Arizona, for example, state law prohibits our department from a role overseeing private schools, a spokesperson for the State Department of Education told ProPublica. In 2024, Arizona's top educational official lauded Mike Tyson, the heavyweight boxer who served time in prison for rape, for his involvement in launching a private school that bore his name, calling Tyson a champion of education. Some states, including Arizona, cannot say how many private schools exist or where they operate despite spending hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars on voucher-style programs. The federal government also does not keep a comprehensive accounting. ProPublica analysed data from 13 states of varying sizes that do publish private school directories and offer public funding to these types of schools, and found that at least 1,500 more are listed today than were 5 years ago, bringing the total to more than 9,600. The numbers provide a rare look into the growth catalysed by friendly legislatures and government money, while public school districts are losing students and closing schools. When public money is available, most private schools take advantage of that funding. In several states, all or nearly all students at some private schools pay tuition with public dollars. For instance, public funds subsidised 99% of all private school students in Iowa this past school year, the third year the program was available. An average of 100 new private schools have launched in Florida each of the last five school years. West Virginia, a state with fewer school-age students than are enrolled in Chicago public schools, has gained about 40 new private schools. And in the 3 years since Arkansas began allowing students to get about $7,000 annually towards tuition, about 120 new private schools opened. ProPublica detailed the consequences of the rapid growth and meagre oversight in Arkansas in a previous story, spotlighting a school where students were subjected to menial labour and violence. The owner there was convicted of permitting child abuse, a felony. The state has said student safety is its top priority, but the school remains eligible to receive state money after a temporary stop. It's been a conservative goal for decades to diminish the role of public schools and privatise American education. A surge in private school funding programs since the pandemic represents significant progress towards that goal. Now about 30 states have some version of a program that allows families to spend public money on private school tuition. EdChoice, a group that advocates for these plans, estimated that more than 1.5 million students are taking advantage of them, and that number is expected to rise further as a federal tax credit program signed into law by President Donald Trump provides the first ever federal plan to fund kindergarten to 12 private schools. The vouchers have allowed some students to access private or religious schools that they previously could not afford, but others, often students with disabilities, are finding that they're excluded from private schools, which, unlike public schools, do not have to admit them. So they're unable to exercise the educational freedom politicians have touted. Even when every single student in a private school pays tuition with public money, that school still operates without the same accountability applied to public schools, where everything from finances to curriculum to student achievement is open to public inspection. The contrasting standards vex those worried for the future of public education. I've got the West Virginia Codebook, which governs public education, which is over 1,300 pages long, said Paul Hardesty, the president of the West Virginia Board of Education and a critic of the state's permissive private school regulations. It's thicker than two Sears catalogues. Rules that govern homeschool and private school in West Virginia, those will fit on an index card. So when things go badly inside the opaque world of many private schools, it can be left to parents, police, journalists and amateur sleuths to find and expose wrongdoing. With state officials lacking oversight, authority in Florida, for instance, concerned parents and citizens in Citrus County began posting online about the prior sexual misconduct of the founder of Crystal River Learning Academy. Even the police chief of the public school system weighed in. Her post included a mugshot of the now leader of the Crystal River School in an orange jumpsuit. She exhorted, "Please do your research." Barnes, go-karts and Mike Tyson. For many, private school evokes images of elite academies, manicured campuses and plaid Catholic school uniforms. But that's not the vast majority of private schools, says Douglas Harris, a Chilean university economist who studies voucher programs and has expressed scepticism that a free market approach works well for schools. They're all over the place and sometimes in places you don't even realise. They're not even advertised. It's important to understanding the potential of where this is and where it is going. In this recent expansion, private schools have opened in farms and barns, addiction to treatment centres, co-working spaces, people's homes and parks. ProPublica's review of 13 states found a West Virginia family opened a school at the Family Fun Centre they operate. It's next to the water park, mini golf course and go-kart track. Tiny new Christian schools began operating in Sunday school spaces in churches are proliferating. At the same time, small fly-by-night schools have been opened by profiteers and people with problematic pasts or no educational experience. And while the majority of American students still attend public schools and the largest share of funding goes to public districts, EdChoice estimated that last year alone, states allocated $10.6 billion to programs that can be used to pay for private schools, a 29% increase over the previous year. One Michigan-based company that launched last year to encourage churches to tap into public funds refers to these programs in its promotional videos as God's new gold mine. In Phoenix, the Mike Tyson-branded Tyson Transformational Technologies Academy, operating in a strip mall, was opened as part of a chain of schools for foster children, unhoused or expelled students, created by former MMA fighter and WWE wrestler Daniel Puda. Tyson lent his name to the academy for $1 a year, has appeared at ceremonies for the school and given motivational speeches to students. This visionary project reflects Tyson's commitment to providing quality education and opportunities. A 2024 news release for the school stated. He was described as a co-founder of the school. Tuition is free to families. The state of Arizona paid the school $231,973 in fiscal year 2025, according to the state education department. Puda explained in a podcast interview that his own journey from fighter to motivational speaker to private school operator began when he and a friend were musing about Puda's efforts to help address bullying at a local school district. My buddy looks at me and I'm like, dude, the turnover in public schools is crazy, Puda said. And he's like, start a school. And I'm like, Jamie, what are you talking about? I'm a special ed kid. I'm like, I didn't graduate college. He's like, no, start a school. I'm like, okay. In addition to the Tyson Academy, Puda now has 8 schools in Florida and 1 in West Virginia, according to the website for the Elevate School, the umbrella company under which the academies operate. After a recent rebranding, the Phoenix School Tyson helped launch is now simply called Elevate, E-L-E-V-8. Puda told ProPublica that Tyson is never left alone with students. ProPublica reached out to Tyson through the Elevate and his Florida publicist, but he did not get a response. In West Virginia, Elevate Schools advertises that tuition is completely covered by the HOPE Scholarship, the state's education savings account program that provides each family with about $5,400 a year in public funds that can be spent on tuition, tutoring or homeschooling supplies. Puda's schools provide tutoring, mentoring and flexible scheduling for teens who may have jobs or are parents themselves. He told ProPublica that he wanted to transform lives and guide students to college, trade, school or the military. Puda has ambitious plans to expand the enterprise with more schools and related components in real estate, school security, artificial intelligence and school health clinics. He's sought investors in a variety of forums, including a webinar called Discover the Investment Model Behind Our State-Funded Private Schools with Mike Tyson. Up until 5 years ago, states provided an opportunity for only a small segment of students, such as those who have disabilities, come from low-income families or would otherwise attend poorly performing public schools, to tap into public money for private school tuition. West Virginia adopted the nation's first program to make these funds universally available in 2021, and today 18 states are inviting any student to partake, regardless of family income or existing private school enrollment. Once schools are open and accepting tax funds, few states then regulate what is taught, what qualifications employees should have, or what funds may be spent on. But it's not just the oversight that private schools get to avoid. They are also free to adopt policies such as discriminatory admissions that public schools cannot. Several private schools in Ohio and Virginia permit paddling as discipline, even though these states outlaw corporal punishment in public schools. As a condition of being tax-exempt, non-profit private schools must attest that they won't discriminate based on race, colour or national or ethnic origin, but they're free to refuse admission to students for a range of other reasons. It's common, for example, for both new and established religious schools to refuse to admit or to expel students who say they're gay or condone homosexuality or whose parents are gay. One school noted on its website that it is permitted to discriminate on the basis of religion in accordance with our statement of faith. Many schools decline to enrol students with disabilities. An Alabama school that opened this past fall says it will expel students who have HIV, gonorrhea or syphilis. Advocates of private school voucher programs argue against restrictions on how the schools operate and push back against the type of oversight enforced on public schools. They fear that any strings attached to the public money will make many private schools balk at taking it. You try not to take the private school system and make it the public school system. Parents are looking for an alternative. They're looking for something that operates differently and they hope serves their child better, says Patrick Wolf, who studies vouchers and similar funding models at the University of Arkansas. His research often highlights the benefits of the systems. Earlier this year, a handful of West Virginia legislators pushed to add some bumpers to the program to safeguard public funds. One provision would have required private schools accepting public money to give a common standardised test and report results to a county superintendent, allowing more insight into the school's educational quality. The proposals didn't pass, and the legislators who had supported them were ousted in the state's May primaries, rebuked by pro-voucher governor and then by voters who sided with the candidates the governor had backed. The lack of private school oversight is built straight into the law in most of the states ProPublica studied. Florida, for example, advertises the Florida Department of Education does not have jurisdiction over private schools. Legislative intent is not to regulate, control, approve or accredit private educational institutions, churches, their ministries, religious instruction, freedoms or rights. It is explicit. As a result, the state takes few steps to protect students from private school educators with troubled pasts. Anyway, I'll leave it there. I highly recommend having a look at it. It can be found at the Network for Public Education or ProPublica. Well, with that, I'll leave you to have a lovely weekend. Cheerio.
Well, we've reached the stage of saying, well, can any good come out of America? That's a very sad story, isn't it? But let's have a break, shall we, and come back with our good news story for the week.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
3CR. We hope you're still listening to the Dogs program. Because although the world's in a bit of a mess, our state schools are still great schools. So let's hear about our good news story for the week, shall we, from Andy.
Thanks, Jean. And this week's great state school of the week is Diggers Rest Primary School. The Diggers Rest Primary School, number 2479, officially commenced on the 19th of June, 1882. With the further development of the township in the mid-1980s, the school population quickly grew. The new school site in Plumpton Road opened in October 1990, catering for approximately 200 students. The new building was established as a modern facility promoting a broad curriculum, attractive spaces and extensive grounds. The school was relocated in the heart of community facilities and is now central to the growth areas surrounding wider Diggers Rest. Diggers Rest Primary School is the only school located within the community of Diggers Rest and, as such, prides itself on strong community connections. In recent years, the school has spent time capturing the spirit of Diggers Rest and now prides itself on empowering all students to excel through a culture of high expectations, purposeful relationships, challenge and support. The school has built upon the original buildings established in the 1980s and is now an exciting and dynamic facility committed to the development of all learners. Diggers Rest Primary School retains a focus on our community traditions whilst also ensuring a student-centred approach where best practice is applied within meaningful contexts. And the principal's message at DRPS, we believe that every action needs to be reflective of our core values. As such, every individual at DRPS is considered unique and full of promise. Our school prides itself on a calm and orderly environment where every child is known and where each individual is both equipped and challenged to chase their dreams. At DRPS, we understand that learning is an interactive process. We recognise the importance of effective engagement and design learning sequences with reference to evidence-based practices. We understand students will learn and grow at different rates, so have designed processes to ensure that each individual is given the opportunity to thrive in their own way. At DRPS, learning is our core business, and all staff members work together to support, extend, and challenge students. Students experience a comprehensive curriculum whilst also ensuring attention to detail with the stepping stones required for effective literacy and numeracy development. Students are offered a broad range of extracurricular activities and an extensive leadership program aims to equip our students with the qualities necessary to become tomorrow's leaders. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. The current enrolment, 560. And the ICSEA value is slightly above average at 1,034, representative of a very outer urban and, in fact, probably semi-rural community. The upper 25% of socio-educational advantage makes up 17% of students. The second quartile, 29%. The third 25%, which is below 50%, is 32% of students, and 23% of students are in the lowest quartile of socio-educational advantage, with 41% having a language background other than English and 2% Indigenous students. The finances are current grants from the Australian Government of $1.518 million and from the Victorian Government, $5.647 million. Private fees and contributions add another $96,000 odd, and other private contributions, another $133,000. And that works out at $14,274 per pupil. The capital, $5.82 million over 3 years. The NAPLAN results, very good. This is a school doing an extraordinary job on very basic funding. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to the Diggers Rest Primary School. And our time is gone. So it's up to me now to thank our wonderful producer, Dale, and her offsider, Andy, and Sorrel and Jeff. We couldn't do this without them. And as you know, public schools need all the friends and the promotion that they can get at the moment in this country. So we are very grateful. And if you want to find out more about us, you can find us at our website at www.adogs.info. But from all of us here at 3CR, it's bye for now.
Saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe here last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
Are you a 3CR subscriber?
We really need our listeners to subscribe to the station.
Call 03-9419 8377 or sign up online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
3CR.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au. And thanks for your support.